Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and great to have back a couple of our regular guests. Lisa Johnson, one of them, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. Lisa, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Larry.
Brian Huddleston, our other guest, is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. And Brian, good to see you as well.
Good to see you, Larry. Thanks for having me today.
As we talk with these guests, I hope you'll join in. We're going to start talking about pruning a little bit. We may talk about rust disease a little bit, but we're certainly ready to take your gardening questions, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Lisa, let's start with you. Why is this a good time of year for pruning?
Well, there are several reasons. One of the best, I'm sure Brian could tell you, is that most of our diseases are not active during the dormant season. So when you make a pruning cut, you don't have to worry about it immediately becoming vulnerable to some kind of pathogen. The other reason is that insects also are dormant at this time of year. And when you make a cut during the dormant season, when the growth does start in spring, it will start to heal over quicker than at some other times of year. And it also doesn't take energy away from the woody plant at this point in time.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking, I wondered if there was a disease that can occur or some problem that can occur, Brian, at this time of the year.
Yeah, my normal recommendation is to prune woody ornamentals during the wintertime, but there is one particular tree where there actually is some data that it's best not to do it in the winter, and that's a honey locust where you're worried about a disease called Nectria canker. There's actually been some research that shows that doing the pruning during the summer when it's hot and dry tends to lead to a lower incidence of this Nectria canker disease. But that's one of the few examples that I'm aware of where I would not recommend winter pruning for a tree or shrub.
Yeah. Well, Doug in Cornucopia has a pruning question, so let's just go to Doug. Thank you for calling.
Hello, this is Doug. I've got a probably a 25-foot weeping willow, and I'm wondering when's the appropriate time to get after it. Now, there's 3 feet of snow up there, so it'll be before May when I get up there. Is that too late, or is that appropriate time?
Definitely not ideal. You don't want to be pruning trees when their leaves are still expanding. So you either want to do it when they are dormant or after the leaves have fully expanded. Now, depending on how late it is in May and what the temperatures have been like, your leaves might be fully expanded by the end of May. It's just that when you do it at that time of year, you end up taking energy away from the plant. Now, with a willow, that might not be such a bad thing. Because, you know, in fact, there are some, like, I'll give you an example. I have some panicle hydrangeas that are quite vigorous, and I also have some viburnums that are quite vigorous. If I prune them in the dormant season, which is when it's generally recommended, they respond by putting on a ton of growth, and then they become even bigger than they were previously, and my goal was to make them smaller. So if I wait until right after the leaves have expanded and I prune them then, I actually will set back the growth and retard the growth a little bit. So it kind of depends on what your goal is, but again, you do open plants to more disease and insect issues. And being that it's a willow, not sure, Brian, what your advice would be disease-wise.
Yeah, lots of canker issues on willow trees. They're kind of a magnet for that, but they tend to grow so rapidly that they don't become serious issues. But I do worry as you're pruning, and this goes whenever you're pruning any type of tree or shrub, I really recommend routine decontamination of pruning tools. Best of all possible worlds would be to decontaminate those tools between every cut. Oftentimes, people aren't willing to spend that much time decontaminating the tools, but do it as often as you possibly can. And you can use things like 70% alcohol. That would be something like rubbing alcohol straight out of the bottle. Rubbing alcohol is actually formulated to be 70% alcohol. You can use the spray disinfectants that you can buy at the grocery store, your big box store. And then also the other option is to use a diluted solution of bleach. It gets a little bit dicey telling you how much to dilute it. It really depends upon the particular brand and formulation you buy. What you need to do is look at the label and look for an ingredient called sodium hypochlorite. That is actually the active ingredient in bleach. And then you want to dilute whatever you buy to until you get to about a 0.5% solution of sodium hypochlorite. And if you want some pointers on how to do this, I just wrote a web article for on my clinic website, and that's pddc.wisc.edu. It's what's called the January Plant Disease Pointers. They'll be listed in the right-hand column on the main page. And I talk about using these materials to decontaminate tools and then give you some step-by-steps on how to dilute whatever type of bleach you buy to the appropriate dilution.
So pddc.wisc.edu.
That's correct.
Okay. There you go, Doug. Thanks so much for calling. By the way, Lisa, what do you use for pruning? What are the best tools for pruning that you use?
Well, there are, I'm not going to go into different brands, but there are three basic types of pruning tools that I use. One is a handheld pruning shears that has a bypass blade where the blades bypass each other like scissors, as opposed to an anvil type where you have a blade that hits a platform in the second blade, and that tends to crush tissue. So you use that for dead material. Of course, you can also use the bypass on dead material. Then the second tool that I use is a loppers, and you can get them with longer handles or shorter handles. And then the third one, which is really important, is a pruning saw. And I tend to use ones that have a slightly curved blade. And let me say that if you do any amount of pruning, it really pays to invest in a good quality tool. Yeah. I struggled for many years with cheaper brands. And when I finally did get a good quality, arborist quality tool, I was like, man, where have you been all my life? It was just amazing. It was like, I can actually cut things.
Slap your head in bed and say, what the heck was I thinking by not getting this sooner?
Yes.
Brian, what
and I'm
you
assuming
add?
Keeping the blades as sharp as possible is important as well. Is that correct, Lisa?
Oh, yes. That is. Thank you for saying that. That's a good thing, too. And we do have a nice fact sheet that's at the Wisconsin Horticulture site on sharpening garden tools, either yourself or you can often hardware stores or other venues will provide that service. It's not something that works well on the saws, but certainly on the loppers and the bypass pruners.
Jim in Dykesville, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jim.
Hello, can you hear me? I'm on my headset looking at my tree in the yard.
You're okay. You're coming through loud and clear.
Great. I've got a maple tree. It's probably 10 inches in diameter, and we haven't pruned it yet. And, of course, we keep banging our heads on the lower branches when we cut lawn and walk around it. I'd like to start pruning it upwards. Is it too soon to prune that tree yet, or can we prune it right now? What do I use? Can I use a small chainsaw, or should I be using a handsaw to saw off those larger branches that are down lower?
Okay. Well, start with you, Lisa.
Sure. You can prune it this time of year. Now, I should warn you that maples are prone to what we call bleeding at this time of year. Just that's where you get maple syrup, right? It's the sap from the inside of the tree, and that starts to rise usually in middle of February or March, depending on where you are and what the temperatures have been like. We still do recommend dormant season pruning for maples, but you know, if you did want to wait until after leaf expansion, you could do that as well. Brian can tell you about things that can grow on the bleeded out sap. Again, it's not damaging for your tree, but it does tend to freak people out a little bit. Depending on the size, the diameter of those branches, you might want to use a pruning saw. You might want to use a chainsaw. We have a very nice fact sheet that is also on the Wisconsin Horticulture webpage on pruning deciduous trees. We usually recommend if the tree branch is over 3 inches in diameter that you might want to get a professional to take care of that. But you're going to use a 3-point cut, which is that you do an undercut, which is a safety cut about 12 to 18 inches out from where the branch attaches to the trunk. And then you can cut off the area of the branch that has the primary weight on it, which is everything else before you made that safety cut. And that cut is made underneath the branch. It's on the underside of the branch, usually a quarter to a third of the way into the diameter of the branch. And what that will do is when you remove that weight from the rest of the branch, it keeps the bark from ripping off all the way down your trunk and creating a huge wound. And it also helps protect you, which is why it's called safety cut. If it's a long branch, you might want to, after you've made that safety cut, start at the long end and take it in sections. That can work out well. And then once you get to your safety cut, then you have just a small stub and you make your cut outside the branch collar, which is that swelling where the branch attaches to the trunk. And all of this is addressed in that fact sheet. It shows you some nice pictures. You want to make sure you don't make what's called a flush cut, which is when you cut into that swelling, because that will make a bigger wound that is really hard for the tree to seal over with callus tissue. So when you cut just outside that branch collar, that makes the smallest wound, and it's easiest for the tree to seal off. Now, you also don't want to leave a stub, so it's important to properly identify that branch collar. If that isn't as clear as mud, hopefully I got that across. But if not, look up branch collar on the internet, and you'll get a lot of nice pictures that'll help explain it better than my poor wording.
I thought you did a nice job, actually, Lisa. Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say the website that Lisa has been referring to, where you can find the pruning fact sheet and how to sharpen tools, is Hort, H-O-R-T dot extension dot W-I-S-C dot E-D-U. And there are a lot of nice horticulture related fact sheets there that you can tap into. And there's one on pruning deciduous trees that's quite nice and shows you this 3-cut technique that Lisa was talking about. And then Lisa mentioned some of the things that potentially can grow on those cut wounds. One of the things I sometimes see where you get a lot of bleeding, and I particularly see this a lot on birches that tend to bleed a lot in the spring anyway, or if you've had sapsucker damage where the bird pokes holes in the tree and then the sap oozes out, you can get a lot of really brightly colored yeast that will colonize that sap because it's very nutritious. And you'll get these vibrantly colored kind of slime trails that will flow down the side of the tree. They can be anywhere from bubblegum pink to pumpkin orange, and they tend to get people very excited, but they're nothing really to be particularly worried about because those organisms don't cause disease. Now, sometimes when you have larger pruning wounds, you can get fungi that are wood rot fungi that will get into the, through those cuts and then will rot the interior wood of the tree. Those oftentimes will produce what are called conchs or shelf fungi. So if you ever see kind of a shelf-like fungal growth akin to a mushroom on the side of your tree, that particular fungus may have gotten into the tree through a pruning cut or some other type of wound.
Mm. That's not good news for the tree when you see those.
No, it really structurally weakens the trees, and then they're more prone to being snapped off or blown over during a high wind. So those are usually a red flag whenever I see them.
And Jim in Dykesville, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Questions for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau's our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. And some emails come in, and we've got lots of callers. So let's take an email, though. Barbara in Middleton emailed her 20-year-old pagoda dogwood is infected with golden canker. The disease branches have been removed by an arborist, but the disease continues. If the tree's not removed, is it safe to plant another pagoda dogwood within 20 feet of it? Or is this disease in the soil and will infect a new tree?
That particular disease is one that's very specific to pagoda dogwood, and usually on pagoda dogwoods that are under some sort of stress, and that can be a fair number of pagoda dogwoods. That particular tree likes shaded conditions. It's an understory tree in its native range and tends to like relatively cool soil temperatures and a little bit moister sites. And so oftentimes people will plant that in a yard. It's such a beautiful tree because it's got this very horizontal branch structure. It's one of my favorite trees, and I really should buy one for my yard because they do have the shade for it. But in any event, people put it in the middle of their yard where it's hot, a lot of direct sun. Oftentimes there's grass growing up to the base of that tree, which stresses the tree for water. And then once the tree is stressed, it becomes more prone to this golden canker disease. And that name is very descriptive. The branches will actually turn a gold color where the fungus infects. Oftentimes there are little orange spots on those branches as well, which are the reproductive structures of the causal fungus. So if you want to plant another pagoda dogwood, I would say that's probably fine as long as you have the right site. If you're putting in another pagoda dogwood and it's going to be stressed the way your original dogwood is, then you're probably going to continue to have problems with that disease. So make sure if you're going to put in another tree, it's in a shaded area, that it's well mulched to keep the soil moist and cool. And I think it should do relatively well. Do watch for, you know, small branches that might become infected and then prune those out. As we've been talking about, you can prune those out during the growing season if you want to. You don't have to wait to the winter to do that. But if you're going to prune out disease branches down about 4 to 6 inches below where you see that obvious kind of gold color, and then decontaminate your tools between cuts. But it's possible, but again, it depends on what your site is like.
Okay, there we go. Let's take a call. Matt and Rudolph, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Sure. I have two questions. One is about pollarding silver maples. If you've had experience with that, if I can do that. And then the second question is about pear mites that I have and how to treat those.
Pollarding. What is pollarding?
It's a specialized pruning technique. I have to admit, I don't have a whole lot of experience with it, but my concern with silver maples is that they tend to be weak wooded, and I'm worried that technique would cause a lot of epicormic sprouts that because it's pretty severe. And I'm worried that it might cause a bunch of epicormic sprouts that are not well attached. And silver maple is such a big tree too that I think there might be problems with it. It's similar to topping in some ways. It's just not something that I really am a great fan of. I know that it is used in various situations, but it can cause, like I say, the weak growth, and I tend to think that it might be an avenue for more disease with all the cuts. What do you think, Brian, about that?
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with the technique either, other than I don't see it very often. I've only seen it outside of Wisconsin, quite frankly.
And, yeah, it's basically where you cut the branches way back, almost right to the trunk, and it forms a very dense head. It's definitely not a look that is, I would say, natural. You know, it's definitely a technique, and I just tend to not be really in favor of it. But again, I don't have a whole lot of experience with it either.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Lisa, that silver maple probably is not the best tree to try this on if you want to attempt the technique, just because it's so soft-wooded, and you might end up with a lot of very weak branches that might be prone to breaking off.
Hmm. What about the pear mites?
Yeah, now I know we have a fact sheet on that. And that should be at the Wisconsin Horticulture.
I don't think we do on that particular one, Lisa.
Am I wrong about that?
Let me double check, but I don't think
okay.
we do.
I know there's I thought there was like a pear blister mite one. But actually, I have your fact sheet list in front of me.
Check it out.
Yeah, not seeing that. I'm wondering which one it is that I'm thinking of then that we have with pears. Not being the entomologist, I don't have a whole lot of recommendations, but I would recommend getting a hold of PJ Leash, who is our entomologist.
Yeah, Matt, you could send a note to the insect. You type in UW Insect Diagnostic Lab into your search engine, and that'll pop up. And you could send a note to PJ, and he's going to have an answer for you on that one. That should, and he's pretty quick about responding too.
Sorry about that. But
that's all right. We can't know every single topic in the world.
My understanding with that insect from listening to PJ and also Phil Pelletieri, who was PJ's predecessor, is it tends to be relatively cosmetic, although I do think in certain situations it can become more of a problem. But most of the time, once you see the damage, it's too late to do anything about it. So, but again, PJ would be a great person to contact. And if you want to, his email is pleash, PLIESCH @ WISC.edu.
Yeah.
Okay. I just looked up what I was remembering. There is something that's on his website, which is insectid.wisc.edu, and there is a pear leaf blister mite article on that.
Okay. Matt, good luck. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's see. Steve in Reedstown, we'll go to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. Say, I was wondering about the time to trim. It is good. I always hear about wintertime. But what happens, like, in the summer if you have a storm and then you have a broken branch on a tree? Do you leave that broken branch until winter, or do you cut it and then treat it some way in the summer differently than because you have to do it in the wrong time.
Yeah.
And I was also wondering about pine trees. I had a couple of big tops, where they have multiple tops. One blew off, like 30 feet long, and it has a big scar up there. Will that heal itself? I mean, it's way up in the air. I can't get to it and do anything about it. And the other thing was like apple trees. I've heard you can trim those any time of the year. And those are, anyway, I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. Lisa, you want to take a crack?
Okay. I missed the type of tree that you mentioned at first. Was that oak or elm?
Red oak.
Red oak.
Red oak. Okay, yes. And you're absolutely right. We try and avoid pruning during the growing season because of oak wilt, which I'm sure Brian will tell you about in just a minute here. But if there is storm damage, yeah, you should definitely clean up that wound and prune that off. However, you should have with you a little can of pruning paint. Now, normally I would never tell you to use pruning paint. The only time that I do tell you to use pruning paint is during the growing season when there's storm damage and you have to make a cut on an oak or an elm. And that's to keep away, it's to provide a physical barrier so that those insects, which actually can, within minutes, get attracted to that wound. And if they are carrying the fungus for Dutch elm disease or for oak wilt, they can infect that tree. So, yes, you do want to clean those up as soon as possible, because again, those insects are attracted to that wounded tissue, and then use the pruning paint. Something that I couldn't quite hear what you said was the tree that you wanted to prune at any time of year or could prune at any time of year.
Yeah, he was just wondering in that case if your oak tree broke, had a broken branch. So yeah. I think you answered that very well.
With the pine, if you can hire an arborist, it sounds like that's a big wound. If it's already been a year, the tree may have already started to seal that over as best it can. But anytime you have a wound, trying to clean that up as best as possible to have smooth edges. Brian will tell you all about pathogens getting into ragged edges. But ideally, I realize you probably can't get up there to do it, but if you can get an arborist, that might help. And apple trees are best pruned during the dormant season for major pruning. And however, if you have something like root suckers coming up from the base, those can be taken out at any time of year. Water sprouts, which are the little thin upright growths in the middle of the canopy, those can be taken out. But structural pruning is best done during the dormant season. And I'll let Brian talk about oak wilt and Dutch elm disease.
Yeah, really for pruning and painting, as Lisa described, I worry much more about oak wilt than Dutch elm disease, because the oak wilt fungus is actually moved around by sap beetles that are attracted to open wounds that are leaking sap. So it is critical to get out there after storm damage, when you're pruning and cleaning up those trees, immediately after making a cut. And I do mean immediately, paint over that wound. And it can be pruning paint, like Lisa mentioned. Quite frankly, I tell folks, if you've got leftover latex paint from painting your house, you can use that on the wound as well. You're just creating a physical barrier that makes that wound less attractive to the sap beetles that can move the oak wilt pathogen into oak trees. With elms, that particular pathogen tends to be moved around more by bark beetles, which oftentimes are going to be tunneling into larger diameter branches. And so I'm not quite as concerned about painting over those wounds. Certainly you can do that if you have a concern, but definitely with oak wilt, the research indicates that within about 10 minutes, sap beetles can visit an open wound. So yeah. It's critical for oak wilt control to cover over those open wounds.
I saw one experiment where they just experimented with to see how long it would take the bugs to get there, and it was under a minute. in that case.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Steve, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ken in Phillips, it's your turn. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've been waiting to say this forever. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Woohoo!
Good to have you with us.
I happen to be a retired utility arborist, and your guests were a little baffled about this pollarding thing and using it on silver maples. And as an arborist of any kind, pollarding is not a technique that you'd be used at all. This was developed in Europe years and years ago as a crop technique to create those water sprouts or suckers, branches, as was mentioned. That's all you're going to get out of it. But they would harvest them on a yearly or bi-yearly basis to make baskets.
Oh.
Okay.
That's why they did it. Okay. That kind of makes sense, I guess. Ken, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That was great. Appreciate it.
I knew it was, you know, I've seen that it was used in the, you know, Roman times, but I never understood what the point was. It just destroys the look of the tree, the health of the tree, and I've never understood what that was used for, but now I get it.
Yeah, now we know. Ken, thank you again. Appreciate it. Tim in Viroqua, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Okay, the reason I called is last spring I planted probably about 1,000 Norway spruce trees. And from little one-year seedlings to four-foot seedlings. And the 100 four-foot seedlings I have look like they're a little stressed right now as we're starting into our spring season again. Some of the leaves are starting, or the needles are starting to turn yellowish-green color, more toward the bottom of the actual tree. And I was wondering if there's anything you can suggest I can do to help them this spring.
Brian, what do you think?
Well, I would say anytime with transplants, the big thing I worry about is how much water they've been getting. And the larger the tree, the more water that they're likely going to need at transplanting. Now, the size that you've mentioned would be in the range that I would normally recommend for transplanting. But was it particularly dry your way last summer?
And what I did throughout the dry season was try to put 5 gallons of water a week on each one of the 4-foot trees. The real small trees look like they all are real healthy.
Yeah. And again, oftentimes when you have water stress, it's a function of tree size. So continuing to water like that is going to be important. I don't think it's probably a disease problem. Norway spruce in general, in my mind, is a pretty sturdy tree. I don't see a lot of disease problems on that particular tree. So the other thing would be to perhaps do some soil testing to see whether or not there are any fertility issues or soil pH issues that you might need to address. Although, Lisa, you may want to comment about fertilizing trees that are that newly transplanted. That's not something I think that's normally recommended. But I think it may be just establishment issues. And the big thing from my mind to get trees vigorously growing is just to make sure they're getting lots of water. My recommendation for new transplants, so that's anything within the size you're talking about, anything during the first 3 years of transplanting would be about 2 inches of water per week. So you may need to up the amount of water if you can do that. If you're planting a whole bunch of trees like that, that can be very, very difficult. But I think the watering is the critical thing.
And the other point is, I've heard you mention, perhaps Lisa has mentioned this, that watering right up until ground freezes, especially for a spruce like that, would be, we tend to, put the hose away or whatever too early often on newly planted in particular.
Yeah, definitely watering, but anytime for evergreens would be once the ground starts to thaw, I would start watering and then continue that. If you were not getting rain, continue that watering through the summer into the fall, all the way up to the point where either the ground freezes or we get a significant snowfall. The trees really need to store a lot of moisture internally so that they don't dehydrate over the wintertime.
Yeah. And for parts of southern Wisconsin, it's pretty dry winter to be for
yes.
sure.
Yes.
So
I was actually out watering on Christmas. Who would have ever thought it? But the ground still was not frozen in my yard, and it was very dry. And I thought, I hate to do this, but on the other hand, I'm really worried about winter burn. And winter burn might be part of what you're seeing, because we did have some very low temperatures and for, you know, kind of a prolonged period of time. And with new trees like that, like Brian and Larry have been saying, that don't have a very big root system, if they aren't really well hydrated going into winter, they might have some dieback issues. I agree, Brian, it's probably just some transplant stress, unless you're seeing widespread evidence of browning and yellowing. But yeah. Absolutely, Larry. I was going to say it if you hadn't, that go in as late in the season as you can with that water, particularly with the very dry fall that we had, at least here in southern Wisconsin.
And as Brian says, start as early as you can in the spring.
Yeah. And I want to compliment the caller on planting smaller size trees.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend that all the time, because so many times people want an instant landscape, so they will transplant in huge trees, and those are much more difficult to get established successfully than if you start with smaller sized trees and just allow them to grow naturally. So kudos to the caller for planting those smaller trees.
Good on you, Tim. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Lisa Johnson, Brian Huddleston, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Always a lot of fun. Should mention that Garden Expo is this weekend through the whole weekend. I know, Lisa, you're going to be involved in some of the activities there.
Yeah, a little bit. We're actually trying to do some remote due to illness and people not being able to come to the booth. We're trying to do a little bit of remote presence. So we'll have a laptop there where you can talk to us through the laptop and the magic of Zoom. And we'll also have most of the time some people at the booth. I'll be giving my talk on rain gardens on Sunday, and then I will be in the booth there the rest of the day.
There we go.
Yeah.
All this weekend. Josh in La Crosse will give you a chance. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Larry. I hope you guys are all doing well today.
We are, and thanks for calling. And what's on your mind?
I've got a couple of big silver maples in my backyard, and the roots, there's big root knobs, balls that kind of grow off of them, and I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do about them. If it's safe to cut them or possibly mound up dirt over the top of them, or do they just need to stay the way they are?
Maples
do tend to have a lot of surface roots, and I know it's annoying. A lot of trees can't tolerate a whole lot of soil piled over those roots. Silver maples might be able to tolerate a little bit because they are river bottom trees. But in general, you just got to leave them. And I recommend planting some ground covers underneath there instead of turf, so you're not trying to mow over those roots.
Yeah, that's a good idea. What kind of ground cover would you recommend?
Oh, gosh, there's lots of different kinds. let's see. How about one of our wonderful natives, wild ginger? That works really well. It's really, I mean, silver maples are such water pigs. It is really tough to get a whole lot to grow really well underneath them. I have some hostas underneath my neighbor's monster silver maple. And those hostas, they're dwarfed. I mean, some of them are supposed to be pretty big, but because of the lack of water, they're smaller, but they still do really well there. But also, if you're looking for a native, the wild ginger might be a good one.
Yeah, wild ginger would be nice under.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go, Josh. Thanks a lot for calling. Mark in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for this call. Question on pruning. Pruning timing for apple and pear trees, and I've got a couple blue spruces that are pretty tall, you know, 40, 50 feet tall, that I want to trim up a little bit on the bottom, that they're dying. And is it okay to prune the dead branches on those?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, dead branches can be taken off at any time of year. That's not going to hurt the tree at all. Brian could probably give you some pointers on potential diseases. Unfortunately, blue spruce is rather subject to rhizosphera and cytospora canker, and
yep.
Can tell you about all the rest. If the branch is totally dead, it's not coming back. So go ahead and take it out.
And he had questions about apple and pear pruning again, Lisa.
Oh, okay.
He was wondering when to prune the apple trees. We did talk about it, but he just tuned in, so it doesn't hurt to repeat.
Yeah, and actually, we've got a really nice fact sheet at the UW Learning Store. If you just put into your browser UW Learning Store. And then when the site comes up, if you put into the search box pruning apples, we've got a really great fact sheet there. Well, it's a publication that has nice drawings and explains exactly how to do it. But both of these trees should be pruned in the dormant season. So now is a great time to start that. Anytime before the buds start showing color. You can do that. And fruit trees should be pruned on an annual basis. You're wanting to prune for proper structure, for weight bearing of the fruit load, but also in order to get light into the center of the tree. The more light that you can get in, the better it is. Now, pears fruit at the ends of the branches, so you do want to. There's a couple of techniques that can be used to maximize the amount of branch ends that you have. Apples, on the other hand, can fruit along the branches. So there are different kinds of techniques to use for that. And I'm sure I could use all the rest of our time talking about what those techniques are and how to use them. But the publication will also be helpful. And we do also have another publication called Growing Pears in Wisconsin that's at the same site, UW Learning Store. And that one does go into particular pruning techniques for pears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'll just comment on Lisa's comment about opening the canopy, getting sunlight in there, and that increases a lot of airflow, which tends to promote really rapid drying of the leaves if those leaves get wet, and that can be a benefit for disease control on apples. The big disease tends to be apple scab, where the fungus infects the leaves, causes a lot of black spotting in the leaves, and then if you've got a really susceptible variety, it will cause defoliation by about midsummer. So anything you can do to open up that canopy to dry things out will help reduce the number of infections that you can get on apples. So, and then with spruces, it's, Lisa mentioned rhizosphere needle cast. That's probably what's causing a lot of the needle loss on the lower branches of your spruce tree. It's very common on Colorado blue spruce and also white spruce, which includes Black Hill spruce. And then also there are various fungi that will infect the branches and girdle those. The biggest one was the one that Lisa mentioned, which is Cytospora canker. Definitely important to get any branches that you think are infected pruned out, because those fungi can grow down the branch and in into the main trunk, and that can girdle the entire tree. So
there you go. And I will say that that apple pruning, apple tree pruning pamphlet is really good. It shows, one of the things it does well is showing you which ones to cut out, which ones to leave, which is very helpful, I think. Mark, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Buffalo County, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah. Okay, I have a white birch tree that the sapsuckers have virtually destroyed. Actually, there's two trees that are going close together, and they're about 20, 25 feet high, but the sapsuckers have destroyed like 4 out of the 6 good limbs on it. And I want to cut it back, or I'm going to just completely replace it. I don't know what kind of growth I could expect if I try to cut back the stuff. The cutting back would take place about 4 feet high in some places, or 10 to 12 feet off the ground.
Hmm.
Have you seen actual dieback that's been caused?
Yep. Yeah, okay. The trees, they're completely dead. There were no leaves or whatnot in those sections this summer.
Oh, so you're thinking...
Neighbor came over and, it was actually my neighbor came over and pointed it out to me.
Yeah. I would think also that with a lot of wounding, you might end up with bronze birch borer in there, maybe adding to the fun. So if you're not seeing any new growth, I would simply remove the trees. And if there's been that kind of damage.
Yeah. I had one kind of like that, Tom, and the arborist came over and said, well, let's see, you got bronze birch borer, you've got, what was the other one, birch leaf miner, and it was, I made one cut right at the base, and that kind of took care of it.
Yeah, that's another tree that tends to be sited improperly in landscape,
yeah.
Oftentimes. Again, it likes a little cooler, shadier, wetter environment, and people put them in dry hot spots, and so they get really stressed and have a lot of problems. The other big one that I see a lot on birch, white birch in particular, is chlorosis, which is an iron deficiency in the tree, usually caused by an overly high soil pH. So that's something when you go to replace the tree, I would do some soil testing to see what the pH is, and then choose trees that are adapted to whatever pH and soil conditions, and also other environmental conditions that you have.
Yeah.
Right. And if you do have a neutral to high pH, stay away from pin oak and river birch.
Yeah. There you go. Good luck, Tom. Thank you. Bill in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, gentlemen, ma'am. I heard you talk about, I have a silver maple right next to a Norway. They plant them too close and their sidewalk's all pushed up and they got roots all over the place on the terrace. So I'm curious. You talk about wild ginger. I have a bunch of wild ginger in my backyard in a shaded area. When would be the best time I should plant that wild ginger? And should I kill off? There's not much grass is growing. There's mostly all weeds and dandelions and maybe some grass because of the roots. Or do I need to throw some more soil down if I plant the wild ginger? And what time of year would be a good time to plant it?
Ideally, early in the spring, that's the easiest time to plant it, when it's coming up and, you know, you can see the silvery, fuzzy leaves. You know, they're small at that time of year. It's a great time of year for transplanting, and it's easy because you're not going to break off a lot of leaves. Gives the plant a lot of time to get adapted over the season and get established. I would try and remove as many weeds and grass as you can ahead of time. When you remove stuff, if it leaves kind of a hole, you can fill that in with soil. But in general, I wouldn't add a whole lot of extra soil if you can help it.
Okay.
You can certainly, though, once you've planted, you can put a couple of inches of shredded bark mulch over that area where you've done the new planting.
And just leave the plants exposed, the new plants. Is that right?
Or would no, you're putting the bark mulch around the new plants.
Okay, I gotcha.
And so on. And, you know, you can kind of spread it over the whole planting area. If it's only a couple of inches with a silver maple, that's not going to make a whole lot of difference. I wouldn't put a lot more than that, but that should be fine.
Bill, thank you so much for calling. Okay. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. One of our guests, the other guest, Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson, back with us. Brian directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Lisa, our UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. So, gardening questions on your mind, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, before we go back to the phones, Brian, I mentioned you were going to talk about a new form of plant rust that you've been seeing, and I don't know that we've talked about that yet, so maybe we should get to that. Brian.
Sorry about that, Larry. My apologies. It turned off, so I didn't disturb during the break. In any event, there are a group of rust diseases that occur on, they actually grow for part of their life cycle on junipers and then another part of their life cycle on certain types of rosaceous woody trees. So things like apples, crab apples, hawthorn, that sort of thing. They're called gymnosporangium rusts. And we have three of those that are common in Wisconsin, cedar apple rust, cedar hawthorn rust, and cedar quince rust. So now we have a fourth one. That's a new one that's been observed in the state called Japanese apple rust. The other common name, which I really like, is called lipstick rust. And there's a reason for that. And again, it alternates between junipers, particularly Chinese junipers, so Juniperus chinensis, and apples and crab apples. And it's native, the fungus is native to Asia, China, Korea, Japan. And it's, you know, it's moved around because we move plant materials around all the time. And it's been found in Wisconsin over in the Milwaukee area on a crabapple variety. I suspect it's probably much more widespread here in the state than we really know. The distinctive symptoms are on the crabapple, where you will get spots with our normal gymnosporangium rust. Usually those spots are bright yellow. With this one, thus the name lipstick rust, they're like fuchsia red. And so you'll get these large dime to nickel shaped spots of this lovely fuchsia red color. And then on the junipers, the fungus tends to induce either a swelling in the branch or a very small diameter gall. And then in the springtime, when it gets wet, it will start to ooze these gelatinous orange arms that are relatively short compared to some of the other gymnosporangium rusts that we typically see. And so we're just asking folks to watch for this. If you think you have an example of this Japanese apple rust, feel free to send in a sample to my clinic. Just label it as a Japanese apple rust. As long as we can afford to do the testing for free, we will do that because we want to kind of map where the disease might be in the state. It's a little bit of a challenge to diagnose it because we actually have to extract DNA from the organism and sequence it, which is a little bit of a pricier sort of tests that we have to do, but we will try to track this as long as we can, as long as our funds are available. So just a new disease on the horizon. We don't see a lot of this A lot of new diseases all the time, so it's kind of exciting when we do see a new one. And I should give credit where credit is due, because this was picked up by the inspectors and the diagnostician at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. They were the ones that actually noticed what looked to be this weird disease on crab apples and got it tested and confirmed as this new disease.
All right, there we go. Let's move to some calls then. David in Baraboo will go to you now. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question. I've got a hedgerow that I put in probably 15 years ago, something like that. A mixture of dogwoods, hazelnut, nine bark, and some sergeant crab. I know how to handle everything else except the sergeant crab. It's well-developed. It's probably 8 foot tall, but it's really starting to encroach on the lawn next to it. I've tried cutting a couple branches sort of in the middle, and everything just seems to die back to the stump. I went online and tried to look it up, and everything I get is a single trunk apple tree and how to prune that. So I'm wondering how to kind of cut back some of the sergeant crab with all those multi trunks.
That is, yeah, I can see where you're coming from. Now, the dieback is what worries me, because that really shouldn't happen unless there's some kind of disease going on. Are you seeing any foliar symptoms, any yellowing of leaves? Or
no, you know, I've got in the area there are sort of wild apple trees, and they seem to do fine. I was just listening to that bit about the juniper, and I've got red cedar around, which may be in that family.
Yeah, that's a type of juniper, but I would not expect the disease, these gymnosperangium resticolae, branch dieback the way you're describing. The sorts of things that might cause that would be possibly fire blight. And then there are some fungal organisms that can get into the branches and girdle them and cause them to die back. But again, this is a situation whenever you're doing whatever pruning you end up doing, routinely decontaminate your tools the way we described earlier with either 70% alcohol, spray disinfectant, or dilute bleach. And that will help if you're accidentally spreading these organisms around.
And do the pruning this time of year during the dormant season. You know, if you want to take some photos of the plant and email them to me at johnson.lisa@countyofdane.com, you can just, I'm sure you can find me through your internet browser if you just type in Lisa Johnson, Dane County Extension. I'd like to take a look at it and see if I can give you some specific recommendations. Normally with a multi-stem fruit tree like that, I would suggest some, you know, thinning cuts, some heading back cuts to an outward facing bud. But I haven't really gotten in my head exactly what yours looks like, and I think I could do a better job of giving you advice if I could actually see the patient rather than trying to recommend it without.
Yeah. All right. David's take some photos and now the time to take those photos, Lisa?
Yes. Yeah. It's we'd like to do the pruning as, you know, as soon as possible here. Dormant season is the time to do it, and this is the best time to be able to see the actual form. And if you can take photos from a few different angles, that would be helpful too, standing back so that I can see the entire shrub / tree and multi-stem extravaganza there. And I'll do the best I can with giving you some pointers.
There you go, David. Thank you so much for calling. Celia in Oshkosh, we'll go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, good. Thank you for taking my call. I have a peach tree that's probably 6 to 7 years old. It's located on Lake Winnebago, so there is a certain amount of moisture. I have several other peach trees on my property, and they've been fine. this disease showed up this year. A friend has trees, and he offered me some spray, which I used. It's an open canopy. I prune the tree, but I had an arborist here for other issues, and he said, well, it still looks like it's alive, but is there anything I can do, and do I need to be concerned about the other peach trees? Because I do get a healthy supply when they're producing.
Yeah, what sort of symptoms are you seeing on the symptomatic tree?
Well, it did a lot of dieback. It dropped a lot of leaves. I cleaned them up. They just kind of curled and fell.
So you had some leaf curl there. Okay.
Yeah, so when they were curly, were they still green and looked viable, or did they curl up as they turned brown and died?
No, they stayed for a while, and I sprayed with a fungicide my friend gave me.
Okay.
And but then towards the end of the season, which would be normal leaf dropping, it had a load of peaches, and I thinned them too.
Okay. Yeah, the curling, if the leaves were still green and they were growing kind of in a distorted sort of manner, could be a disease called peach leaf curl. It's a fungal disease. Quite frankly, spraying the leaves once you see symptoms really doesn't do any good for that particular disease. When you need to apply materials would be while the trees are dormant. So going out just before the trees begin to leaf out, and you can apply a copper-containing fungicide that is labeled for use on fruit trees. And you want to get that material on the branches, because that's where the fungus overwinters, is on the branches. And if you continue to see some problems, sometimes doing a second application after the trees drop their leaves in the fall will provide additional control. So that may be part of what's going on. I would also watch, if you're getting branch dieback, watch to see if you see any blobs of sap on the branches, because peach trees tend to get a lot of what's called bacterial canker. And that's bacterium gets in usually through wounds. So that can be through pruning cuts. Oftentimes with peach, it's through cold injury wounds. And the bacterium gets in and then will girdle the branches and cause those to die back. The other thing that might cause branch dieback would be a root problem of some kind, so a root rot. If you want to explore those, we'd have to make arrangements for you to get a root sample into the clinic for testing, because those you really can't diagnose based on visual symptoms. But there could be a variety of things. If the tree was really loaded with fruits, it sounds like it might have been under some stress as well, because trees tend to produce more fruit when they're stressed. So that could indicate some sort of environmental stresses on the tree as well. So there could be multiple things that are going on with this tree without seeing what the tree looks like and having more information. It's about as specific as I can get. I will mention, I mentioned my clinic website, pddc.wisc.edu, where we have fact sheets. We have fact sheets on peach leaf curl and bacterial canker if you'd like to read more about those.
You know, there's another possibility too, if there's been dieback, is the peach tree borer. If you see any small holes near the base and kind of a sawdusty substance, you could have that. And that tends to happen to older and stressed trees as well.
So that's there. And, you know, all else, Celia's worried about this spreading over to the other peach trees.
The peach leaf curl could go to the other trees. Again, it usually doesn't cause a ton of serious damage to the trees. And again, if it starts to look as though it's getting progressively worse over several years, then again, those treatments to the branches during the dormant period usually can take care of that fairly easily. The bacterial canker that I mentioned, again, that tends to be, in my mind, a wound-related disease. So oftentimes it's getting in through some sort of damage in the tree. So if those other trees are hardy for your area, if they're not being bruised or otherwise damaged, that's kind of a hit or miss sort of thing. If you get damage, you'll probably see some of it. But get in there and prune out those diseased branches where you see the blobs of sap. Prune down about 12 inches to get those out of the tree, and that usually can take care of the problem. The root rots, those are more, again, those would have to be diagnosed separately, and then I could make fungicide recommendations for those, but it doesn't sound like, and those usually aren't as likely to spread as some of these other sorts of things are. And then the birch borer, or sorry, the peach borer that Lisa was talking about, again, just good maintenance of your trees, good watering, that sort of thing to reduce any sort of stresses is probably going to help prevent that from being a serious problem.
There you go, Celia. Thank you for calling. Peter and Kimberly, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I have a big leaf magnolia tree. I was wondering if there's any precautions for pruning that. I have several suckers on it, and I was wondering if I could possibly get the root system off them suckers.
Okay, so you've got suckers coming up from the base, correct?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're asking if you can dig up those suckers with a root system? Is that what you're asking?
Well, right. I was wondering close to the trunk of the tree, but I haven't dug up a little bit and see how they are, but...
You're wanting to take those and replant those, Peter?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So I probably would wait until like April to do something like that if that's what you want. However, I am not sure. I think most magnolias are grown.
Oh, we lost.
Lisa's frozen up.
Yeah, Lisa froze up there. So I think she was trying to talk about whether they were grown from
grafted,
grafted or not.
Yeah, and if the sprouts are coming, if they are grafted and the sprouts are coming up from the graft, then what you get if you do take those sprouts and are able to get them off and transplanted may not look anything at all like the tree that you currently have. So that's one of the disadvantages of taking sprouts like that.
Yeah. Peter, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Anne in Warrenville, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'll try to be quick here. I've got apple trees. I know we've already talked about apple trees a lot, but this is a little bit different. I have two apple trees that I planted about 30 years ago, and when they got to the point at which I had to get on a ladder to harvest the apples, I said, I can't do this. So I started pruning it so they never got over about 8 feet tall, which meant that I ended up with trees that have sort of horizontal branches going out, and I've tried to keep the centers open. And I looked at your sheet on the Learn site, and it doesn't really deal with what I now have. I did the kinds of things that talked about early on. So now what happens is every year I get massive amounts of water sprouts springing up as the tree tries to grow above the 8 feet that I'm allowing it to do. And it's taking me lots and lots of time, you know, to just trim that back every year. And I'm just wondering, is there any way to keep it from making quite so many water sprouts or something I can do to be more efficient about this?
No, and likely not, because that's just the nature of what the tree is going to do when you have a canopy of that sort. So they tend to form those water sprouts. So the other thing you might want to consider, since it sounds like the tree that you have in place is overly large, would be consider, if you have some space, planting some newer varieties that are dwarf varieties that won't get really tall, so that you don't have to try to continually prune them the way you're doing your existing trees. So that would be something. And then one of the nice things, if you have the space to do that, you can experiment with some different varieties than what you currently have, and maybe get some apples with different flavors and that might be appealing to you.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff in Eau Claire emailed to say he has a large chestnut tree and has discovered many smaller ones just down the slope in the woods. Can he transplant them, and can he plant them in his meadow?
Yeah, that unfortunately, I can't answer that particular question. I wonder if these are true American chestnuts, because that would be somewhat unusual, because there's a really serious disease of that particular tree called chestnut blight that has pretty much wiped out most of the American chestnuts in the U.S. There's still a few around, but I can't comment on transplanting. I don't know how well those particular trees transplant.
As we think about spring, which I'm sure all of us are right about now, Brian, anything that we ought to, we haven't talked about in the way of disease or what we can do to, you know, sort of get ahead of things?
The most important thing for me as people are thinking about planting new trees and shrubs is to make sure those trees and shrubs are planted in the proper way. Because of COVID, I'm doing a lot more digital diagnostics. And so I get to see how entire trees have been planted and established in landscapes. And there's been a lot of historical situations where these trees have not been planted as optimally as they could be. So whenever you're deciding a first right plant in the right place, so make sure that the tree or shrub will survive in the light conditions, soil conditions, moisture conditions that are available where you want to plant it. So pair the right plant with the right site. And then also when you buy materials, particularly if you're buying bald and burlap materials, when you bring those in, make sure you remove that burlap bag on the outside. There'll be a wire basket underneath. Make sure that's removed. And then oftentimes there's a lot of soil that's been piled up around the crown of that tree or shrub. Make sure you carefully remove that until you get down to what's called the root flare, which is where the trunk widens to form the root system. And that root flare needs to be planted just above the soil line. A lot of trees I see problems with where they're dying back have been planted too deeply historically. So that root flare has been buried. They tend to develop curling roots, which will grow around the trunk and then kind of, for lack of a better description, strangle the tree. And a lot of that can be avoided if the trees and shrubs are planted properly to begin with. And then good mulching. So a couple of inches if you're on a heavier soil, maybe a little bit more, 3 to 4 inches on a really sandy soil, and then good watering. So that 2 inches per week for evergreens from when the ground thaws all the way through when it freezes in the fall. For deciduous trees, start watering when they start to leaf out up until the point in the fall where they start to turn their normal fall color. Do that for if you're planting smaller sized trees for about 3 years. Post-planting, and then you can cut back to about an inch of water per week.
And on that note, and I would say, pull that mulch away from the bark of the tree.
That's right.
Don't make it in contact with the tree itself. I knew you were going to say that, but I thought I'd jump in.
No, thank you for adding that.
Brian Adelson, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, and Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, our guest. And they'll be back, I'm sure of that. Monday at this time, tech expert Beth D'Angelo will be back to talk about romance scams, the metaverse, and blockchain technology. That's Monday at 11. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.